Are you watching these TikToks where people are trying to, like, people in office buildings are trying to outrun their coworker as Michael Myers?
No.
It is the scariest thing, because it's like a guy in a suit. It's like
well, he's
Brad
walking,
from a
couch.
He's walking.
Yeah.
And then
Halloween.
Yeah. Yes. And they've got the
Not
key.
Shrek.
They have to unlock the door and then get in and then lock the door. And like 90% of them don't make it.
Oh my
and
God.
It is terrifying. Every single
really?
Time. There's not even a fake knife in their hand. Because the guy's just walking slowly and these people are running for their
so
fucking
they set
lives.
Up, Michael Myers set up the maze?
Yeah.
I guess?
Yes. And it's so scary. I shared it to my story and I've gotten so many DM people being like, this is so scary.
Really?
Yeah. I'll send it to you. It's terrifying.
What happens when he catches up to
just
them?
Like, and then, but like the people always scream because it's like you feel like you're being murdered by Michael Myers.
Oh my God.
It's terrifying.
You don't have time for that.
No. Hi, Jillian Bezzavalli.
Hello, Patrick Hines.
So, fam, once again, this is episode 2 of our coverage of Andrea Yates, The Cult Behind the Killer. This was on the Patreon last week. This is our regular episode this week.
Yes.
Is there anything we need to tell them about before we start?
Just the, like, same old, same old. It's a party over on the Patreon. We have a YouTube. We have a Discord.
YouTube has 230 subscribers. Go watch us. Go watch this episode on YouTube.
So we're going to dive in. We're, like, halfway through the second episode of the series. So we're going to do the second half of episode 2 and then all of episode 3 in this ep.
Yeah.
And reminder, if you were screaming at us last episode, we're going to do, like, a recap of what they left out at the end of this.
Yes. You want to bring the fam up to speed?
Well, everything's a mess, honestly. Yeah. Like, there's really no other way to slice it. Like, we're with Rusty Yates, who's Andrea's husband, and David, the yuppie, who's a former cult member, and Moses, who was born into it, and he's a former cult member. He's an adult now, but he was a kid. And so everyone's families are falling apart. Andrea was told, do not have any more kids. Your postpartum is going to come back worse and, like, stronger, for lack of a better term.
Yes, and they had one more after that.
And also, like, I don't know shit about shit. Like, obviously, I'm not, like, making a joke, like, no experience with postpartum depression. I never will.
Yes.
Like, I know that it looks different for so many people. Like, I'm not an expert here, but, like, I'm just repeating what the doctors are saying. And it's like Andrew's postpartum depression was exacerbated by so many other factors in her life.
Yeah.
Including this fucking cult.
Yeah. So we're back with Rusty, and Rusty is being very clear to us that he's had no communication with Michael. Andrea has. Now, we also learned that Rachel, Michael, the cult leader's wife, is writing letters to Andrea.
Did you see how she signs it?
She signs it. Oh, Michael's servant.
Michael's servant.
How insane
so
is that? I'm going to start signing my letters, Steve's servant.
I'm like, Jesus Christ, please don't. That's so barfy.
I know.
What happened to satanically infested?
I know. That's for sure.
Satanically yours.
Exactly.
Jillian. So November 2000, Mary Yates is born. So this is Andrea Yates' fifth child. And again, she was told not to have another child for her safety and the safety of the children.
Yeah.
So Andrea is communicating with the cult leader and Rachel. And like, she's also not taking the medication.
No. And like, as predicted by the doctor, her symptoms have come back and they're worse.
They're worse.
She was just staring blankly ahead. Had a scissor leg, picking at her hair, not saying anything. So I called around to try to see a psychiatrist. Oh, yeah, we got an opening, 6 weeks. I'm like, we don't have 6 weeks, you know? I didn't know what to do. I'm like, who do you call?
She's suffering and no one's helping her. And the cult is just telling her to, quote, look to Jesus. And I'm like, well, I heard an audio cassette an hour ago that said that there was no Jesus.
Right.
So we're like.
And also, like, we get sprinkled in the second half of this series that, like, Rachel is writing these letters to her. And not only, like, pretty much blaming her for her own, like, depression that she's in. But this is where we start to get the nuggets of, like, fix your children. Your children must be saved.
TikTok.
Or they're going to burn in hell and you're going
to
burn in hell.
And it has to happen before they're 12.
Yes. What do they call it? The age of what?
I don't know.
Age of accountability.
Jesus Christ. They're
the
kids.
Age of accountability.
Lighten up.
Daisy's going to be 12 in 2 weeks. She's not accountable, girl.
I was going to say, accountability is accountability.
Exactly.
So David the yuppie, he dumped his fiance. He's still heartbroken over it.
Yeah.
He quit his cushy job that he worked really hard for and he was proud to have. And now he is living in the woods, obsessing over Michael. Michael and his, quote, teachings.
Now, this is what David has decided to do with his life, because Michael told him the reason you can't get married, the reason you can't, you have not had a divine intervention from God. And so that's why he goes into the mountains to, like, obsess over Michael's tapes, to obsess over all the pamphlets.
And he's now terrified of the world around him.
Yes.
Again, just a reminder, see, we do this all in one sitting.
Yeah.
So it feels like I'm repeating myself, which I am. But in case you are, like, it's been a week since you've heard us talk about this.
Yeah.
This all happened through the mail.
Yes.
They were not in person. They were in different states. So these are all like cassettes and letters.
Yeah.
And David is spiraling and is so terrified of the world around him that he has isolated himself into the woods.
I would just pray and ask God, you know, please give me light. God, you know I want you. Every night, I'd be begging, pleading, please open my eyes. But there was no divine encounter. At that point, I started shutting down.
He is now suicidal.
And he literally says, I would just pray and beg and plead to God for a divine encounter. He's alone in a cabin in the woods.
Yeah.
Begging God for a divine encounter. Like, can't you just fake a divine encounter?
And imagine what would happen if, this should scare you because it was happening in the 80s over the mail.
Yes.
Like, there was time to decompress, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, this should scare you, especially in the age of the internet. Like, what is possible and how vulnerable people are.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, David, thankfully, obviously, does not do this.
Yeah.
But afterwards, things are pretty dark because he describes it. He goes, I had clinical depression. I had spiritual depression. Like, can you imagine?
No, but that's the thing. Like, he sat there in a chair with a gun in his mouth. And by the grace of God, that's your divine intervention, David. The fact that you did not pull the trigger
is your
message from God.
And then he says something chilling. He goes, like, what would happen? Like, can you imagine if something crazy like that happened? He goes, oh, wait, there was someone who had both of those things. Her name was Andrea Yates. That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And he kind of says it in this really biting tone of like, this was happening. Clearly.
Yes.
This is what was happening
and
to her.
And it's the marriage of the clinical depression and the spiritual depression. That's what he's talking about. That's
right.
what Andrea Yates suffered from.
Right. And postpartum and, in my opinion, an abusive home life.
Isn't it so wild that, like, at the time that this all happened, nobody, Oprah, anybody, no, like, because Oprah did a whole show on this, nobody asked why. Nobody no. took a minute. We'll meet the one person who did in
yeah.
a minute, the writer who wrote the book on this case. But, like, everyone just accepted that she was nuts, that she was crazy, that she was evil.
It was easier.
Nobody scratched below the surface.
It's easier to discount someone like that is crazy because you can't imagine
yeah. I mean,
anything like it.
I feel better knowing. I'm glad to know the reason.
And there were to me, you can clearly see point A to B to C. We didn't just like wake up here. No way.
But the public didn't.
Of course, you know, for years.
Like, yeah, yeah.
That's what I was saying like when we were teasing these episodes in the last week or 2 weeks ago now or whatever.
15 minutes, 5 minutes ago?
Time yeah. is a construct. But like it was like very much like the hot coffee case in the sense where everyone was like, what a fucking idiot. Of course that liquid's gonna be hot. But it's like, no, can you wait a second?
Yeah, yeah.
Hold on.
I keep thinking about Tonya Harding and all of
this.
You know what I mean?
So like, much, there's yes. like just so much here. And this is one of those big cases where if you just, again, like you're saying, ask a freaking question.
Yeah.
So we learn that Andrea's brother and Rusty have to carry Andrea Yates to a mental hospital. And then they drop that in there and we will get back with that because now we have to see this video of Michael, the cult leader, as Satan wearing some spirit Halloween cape and red horns and a stupid mask and a wig.
Because what's happened is David isolated in a cabin. 5 minutes ago, he was sitting in a chair with a gun in his mouth. Literally, I'm not making a joke about
it.
He reached out to David to let him know how spiritually low he was.
For help. Asking for help.
To his spiritual daddy, literally.
That's what he does.
And instead of calling him, going to see him, like letting him know that everything's going to be okay, he sends him a video dressed as Satan doing that Satan voice.
Like that deep, but it's like a deep, tough guy voice.
Well, because he's
Satan.
Telling him that
you're wrong, that you must stop and change what you're doing. No reason for you. You have just some awkward, uncomfortable feelings of change. No.
you're just not man enough. Like, you're just not man enough to be able to handle all of this. You're just not man enough to get a divine message from the Lord. And so David starts to see the devil in his everyday life.
Can you imagine this fucking cult leader on set?
Oh my God. Well, it was also like a Halloween town cult. You know what I mean?
It was
like,
Spirit Halloween King.
It was so awful.
But I mean, how insufferable he'd be like Rachel.
Oh, yes.
The lighting is a good, first of all, the lighting sucks. It's just so, it's like, you want to laugh at it because you're like, how are we here? But that should be like, oh, we're here. We're in this part of the program.
I just can't imagine the isolation of David in the middle of nowhere, having quit his job. And like the part that gets sort of glossed over, they talk about it for a second. He loved that woman.
And she was there for him saying, you have to snap out of this.
Yeah.
He's crazy. You're not. I'm not. Like, we can't.
Just stop listening to the tapes, you know?
Right. Like, let's do this. Let's do this life for real. The life that, like, David pretty much had in a lot of ways.
And it's funny because I keep thinking about how, like, cult leaders want to isolate their victims or whatever. And, like, Michael wasn't there to isolate him, but he was able to isolate him anyway.
I know.
He was able to get him to, like, self-isolate.
So after David's like, I really need help, Michael wants to meet with David the yuppie to talk shit about Satan and all of this like impending violence and destruction.
So we learn that David has a friend, this guy Richard, who he grew up with together, and they got into this cult together or whatever.
They're frat brothers.
They're frat brothers. So like David doesn't tell anybody except for Richard about this meeting with Michael, and Richard is gonna go with Michael to this meeting. Now, David says,
I thought because I wasn't progressing, he was coming to my aid, you know, much like a spiritual doctor. And I envisioned spending hours with him in a park or someplace quiet. But what I found peculiar was a place he chose to meet. A McDonald's restaurant.
He wants to meet in a McDonald's and then berate these two over a couple of McGriddles.
Scream.
Yeah.
It's like, sir, this is a Wendy's, only it's a McDonald's.
Yes, exactly.
Screaming.
Yeah.
And this is the first time they've seen each other since 1987. This shit has been going on through the mail for like 13 years.
And for the record, when they saw each other in 1987, they didn't meet. Like, David saw him, like, quote, preaching on campus at his school. They never talked.
Yeah.
This is the first, like, face-to-face conversation they've ever had.
David's like, I thought we were going to shit talk Satan, not like have you scream at me about how I'm worthless.
And like, how dare you start to talk about the Wizard of Oz?
I mean,
Michael is comparing what David is going through to the opening scene of the Wizard of Oz. He says, you're caught up in the winds of delusion. Now, the good news for David is that according to Michael, there's some hope for him. Richard, not so much. Michael is berating this guy over a crispy Diet Coke about how worthless he is.
Full fat Coke, if you're me.
Yeah, full fat Coke. He'll never be saved. This guy's going to burn in hell no matter what he does.
Richard walks out of that McDonald's suicidal.
Yes.
He wasn't, I don't think, before, but now maybe he was like, oh my God, David, like, cult leader, I need your help.
Yes.
But he walks out of that meeting suicidal.
He scared me, and I was emotionally exhausted. Because it took everything I had to convince him to not do it now. And he's my friend. I loved him. He was my childhood friend. And I know he's going to do it because I know how he feels. I know what he's under.
After hours and hours of breaking down with David the yuppie, David talks him out of it because he was like, I was there a week ago. Please don't do this.
He literally, like, David describes the scene. He's like, Richard showed up at my house in the middle of the night to tell me that he was going to go kill himself. This was not a question. This was not to be discussed. He was just letting him know the end is here and I'm going to go do it.
Because he's too worthless to live.
Yes.
Because he can't do all of the things that he's supposed to do. The reason he's so upset and depressed is his own fault. Like, that's what this guy is screaming at them.
Yes.
That you're worthless and you deserve to die. And Richard's like, well, fuck it.
And like, all of this is a precursor to the Yates kids being murdered. This is what this man is doing. He's teaching you that if you can't get saved or whatever, you're going to burn in hell, but there's also no way to get saved.
And David, thankfully, saves his friend's life. Richard does not go through with it.
Yes. We talked to Moses for a second. His parents have gotten divorced. The mom got the kids, the dad got the bus, and Moses has to sneak onto the bus to get, like, to steal the tapes. And so he tells us about this trip where they, like, go back down wherever Michael's family lives.
Florida.
And they're now out on the street preaching again. And Moses is saying, like, this was the first time I was old enough to be embarrassed.
Uh-huh.
This
yeah.
was the first time I was old enough to see the looks on people's faces as we were doing this.
To be perceived, as they say. You know, that people are like, oh my God, look at that crazy family.
And I, like, he doesn't say this here, but like this is where it's like starting to crack for Moses a little tiny bit.
Yeah.
But like as far as we know, he's the only member of his family who ever had any thought that like what's going on here is all fucked up.
I hope his sister's okay.
I hope so. I hope she's still friends with that girl from camp.
I know. So back with Andrea Yates, she has now spent 2 weeks in the hospital and her insurance has run out apparently. And so she is now home.
Can I just say too, Rusty says,
Andrea was the sickest patient in that building. I mean, you could just tell she was like not hardly moving, not responsive, not communicative. When she came home, she was completely out of it. I didn't know it at the time, but Andrea was having visual hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, and it led to the delusions she had of having the devil in her.
And it gets to the point where she thinks that the devil is inside her, in her mind, in her body, in her soul. And it ends, this episode, the second episode ends with Moses saying, look, I know it sounds crazy, but I totally get it. And I totally get what she was feeling, what she was hearing, and I completely understand how she got to a point where she did what she did.
And I want to say, we see a video of the funeral, and like the thing that, where I started crying for like the fifth time today is we see the caskets.
I know.
And the caskets are so small, you can't believe it. I was shaken by the visual of the coffins.
I know.
I was shaken by how small they were.
Yeah, yeah.
How few people it took to carry them.
I know. How many there were at the same time.
Five. And like Rusty, I know we hate him, but like he had to give five eulogies in one day.
And like what Moses is saying is in Andrea's mind, she did what she was supposed to do.
Yes.
She was saving her children. She was making the ultimate sacrifice. She didn't want to do this.
No.
She had to do this.
Because once again, and we'll get more into this in episode three of this, which is what we're about to get to now. Like the religious teachings taught her that if she could not make her children saved by the age of 12, they were all going to burn in hell.
And the reason she was feeling like Satan was inside of her is because they weren't saved yet.
Right. And the other thing too to add, and Moses gets into this a lot, is it's not just about not burning in hell. It's about how amazing heaven is.
I guess, but it's weird. I haven't heard anything about that in any of these cassettes. It's that there is no salvation, or maybe he's saying there is no salvation if you don't get your shit together. But like nothing seems nice or loving about anything of these teachings.
It also can't go unstated that only eight people were getting into heaven. And like the Michaels family was eight. So like that the urgency for her kids to get to heaven first was also weighing on her.
Yeah. Okay, so episode three is called Revelation. And this is where we just very quickly learn exactly what Andrea Yates did. She drowned her children one by one in the bathtub.
Yeah.
And so this is when we meet Susie Spencer. I think it's important that we learn that before we meet Susie.
Yeah. Susie Spencer's also a name you change your name to. Like, that's
Susie
a great
Spencer.
Name.
That's like a comic book character, but she's a superhero.
Susie Spencer, she works for like the Daily Bugle or whatever.
Yeah. So she's the author of a book called Breaking Point. And she, before she knew anything about this case, she was like, I'm going to write the book on this because this seems crazy.
When I was researching my book, Breaking Point, I was starting to get hints that no, she wasn't this horrible, evil person that was on the news. Her neighbors were saying she was a people pleaser and she was a caretaker. And everyone said, what a great mom. I was getting a totally different picture of Andrea.
The news has her photo everywhere. And it's like this evil, calculating, conniving, evil woman. And the neighbors are like, No. She was a great mom. And she was like, really nice.
What is the next sentence in that article? You know what I mean? Like, what's the reason? Like, she was just crazy?
She was like a bloodthirsty, insane woman.
That's just crazy.
Who out of the blue did this?
Her own husband is out there to the press, to every camera he can see. Like, this wasn't her fault. That's not who that was. Like, she's not that woman.
Well, that sells more papers. It gets more viewers. It gets more.
And it's legitimately all I knew about this case. You know?
And it's easier, I think, to like, oh, she snapped and went crazy. That can't be me.
But I mean, Susie's getting the scoop, you know what I mean? Like, because outside of like humanizing Andrea and coming to an understanding about like how dangerous these kinds of cults are, it's a much more interesting story to learn the nuance of all this.
Right. And so, but someone sends Susie letters.
Yeah.
Someone sends her the letters from the cult, Michael and Rachel, to Andrea.
And I get the sense that Susie still doesn't know to this day who it is.
And now Andrea was pouring everything out to these people, like her anguish, her loneliness, and their response—
to Michael and Rachel.
To Michael and Rachel in the cult. And they were not helpful at all.
No.
It was fear. It was manipulation. It was everything Andrea was doing wrong, and like she's possessed by the devil and there's no hope for her. They were encouraging her to do this horrible thing.
And that's exactly right, because they're also talking about the kids. That if you don't manage to save your kids, Andrea, you know you're going to burn in hell and they're going to burn in hell with you. Like this idea was put in her mind by these people.
And it's like, how bad do you want this to be, Andrea?
Right.
Get ahead of this now.
By the way, the only way to get ahead of it is to just keep beating your fucking kids.
I mean,
you know, like that's literally the only avenue she has to make her kids saved or whatever.
And we are told that there is no evidence of that. There are witnesses that come that, like, Susie meets or whatever that say, like, she wasn't abusing them in that way.
No.
That people weren't witnessing that.
Yeah.
So Michael, the cult leader, is all over the news. And so, like, once he's on the news, all the, like, cult followers are just like, wait a second. They send the video of Michael doing that Satan cosplay thing to be like, no, this is who this guy really is. Like, dig deeper. Keep looking into him.
Which is wild, because this is where we get David. David is watching a talk show with Susie the writer.
Here's the thing. I knew, you know, what happened to me, you know, what he did to my life. But it just, when it hit me, like, oh no, this Andrea Yates was so pressurized with that struggle for salvation that she had to kill her kids. And that's what's like, oh my God, how far can this go?
She wasn't evil. This is what happened to her. So we are now jumping to David out of the cult.
Yes.
And we don't get the story. Like the last we saw David, he was convincing his friend not to kill himself, but we don't know how David broke away.
I think it's sort of a little bit implied that he saw this on the news and went, oh, fuck. Like, I think he recognized himself in Andrea in the only way he could as like, oh.
Well, also because David would not have known. So David would have known the Andrea Yates story, but he would not have known that Andrea was in the cult because, like, Michael didn't share that kind of information with people.
I guess. And I think probably talking his friend out of it. Like, when you, like, that's why people say, like, talk to yourself the way you talk to your best friend.
Yeah.
Be nice to yourself. Say, like, you can talk around someone else's anxiety when you're not in it.
Yeah.
So I wonder if David having to talk his friend off a ledge sort of made him wake up and be like, no, we can do this. Like, we deserve to live.
I agree with that 100%, but I also think he also, just because he was a person in the world, knew about this woman who drowned her kids, was watching a talk show about it and realized, like, had a big moment of revelation that, like, oh my God, she's been suffering the same abuse
the same
that
thing.
I've been, like, and David probably in that instant, like Moses, understood why she did what she did and now realizes he's got to tell people.
Right, because then Michael, the cult leader, is all over the news defending the cult, and that's when David's like, no.
Yes.
Absolutely not.
Yes.
Because this David guy can't wait to go on the news. And that was a really stupid move because other people around the country, like, David doesn't know how many people are in the cult.
Right.
So now people are like, oh, I know that guy. And like my dad or, you know, my mom or my sister or my whatever, and ratting him out.
And by the way, Moses is telling us that they're, remember, Moses is related to Michael. Moses's mother is the niece of Michael. Like, they're in the family.
The cult leader is his great uncle.
Exactly. And Moses is saying, like,
we watched the news coverage like a hawk. It was all through the frame of, these people are going to try to bring Michael down. Michael reached out to my mom initially. He was like, hey, how are you? And it was like, oddly nice. It became pretty clear that Michael was afraid that this would be pinned on him.
So Michael is now in damage control. Michael is now trying to, like, do PR because Michael, who's been horrible to Moses' mother, they've been not in communication for 2 years, contacts the mother and is nice to her for the first time ever.
Because he needs a favor.
They're, like, he's saying, like, they're going to try to pin this on me and, like, needs her to be the mouthpiece that, like, he's a good guy. This isn't on him.
Yeah, can you help me out? Maybe don't mention the fact that we were all beating the children, but, like, I'm a good guy, right?
And don't let
nothing
on.
Nothing says I'm a good guy.
Right, exactly.
Like, begging someone.
But also, he's saying to her, don't let on to the world that I was running around telling people that the only way that these kids were going to burn in hell.
Yeah.
If they weren't corrected. Like Michael is connecting the dots and understanding that other people have the information that of course she killed her kids because it was the only way to save them and that teaching came directly from Michael.
And the cat's out of the bag because Susie's got the letters.
Exactly.
February 18th, 2002, the trial. Wendell Odom Jr. is the defense attorney. No relation to Leslie Odom Jr. I know we're all thinking it. No relation.
Although we are about to be in the room where it happens, if you know what I mean.
Well, he's here.
Yeah, Wendell's here. Yeah.
So he is her defense attorney, and he says Andrea Yates on site was, quote, shocking. He says
she had pupils that were giant and dark. She would jerk her head around and be looking at something behind her. I've never seen anyone that mentally ill before in my life. It was clear we need to start building an insanity defense.
It was clear to me that we needed to start building an insanity defense. And in parentheses, he doesn't say, and it's not bullshit for the first time in history.
I know. I'm like, I agree.
Yeah.
And a rare twist.
Yes.
I'm like, fuck yeah, insanity plea.
Yes.
Like, we got to help this woman.
And I want to, like, I want a different word than insanity.
You know what I mean?
Like, I want, like, a woman who desperately needed help and did something she absolutely did not want to do because she was trying to save her kids because this crazy guy made her do
it. And she was driven to it, and her husband didn't listen to her, and no one was helping her, and they kicked her out of the hospital for insurance and blah, and.
Yeah, I don't think that's too long to say. You know what I mean?
It's a little wordy.
It doesn't roll off the tongue.
But
I will take it over insanity.
Like, satanically infested.
Exactly.
For the win.
For the win.
Every single person around says that Andrea is a great mother. So when this defense attorney sees the Andrea in front of him and is hearing from her mother, her sister, her coworkers, all of these people, what she was really like, he's like, okay, how did we get here? We got to figure out how we got here.
Yes. And I want to also say, and I think this is an important point, Wendell, we see him talking to the jury. He's saying she may have known what she was doing was illegal, but she did not know that it was wrong. Like, it cannot be said firmly enough.
Yeah.
She thought she was saving her kids.
Right.
Because to Andrea, this earthly plane is only for now, and heaven is the answer.
She wasn't happy about this.
She wasn't happy about it, but she was like, she wasn't hurting them. She was helping them in her mind.
And I do want to say that I personally think being raised in this world is inherently abusive. Like,
no question.
I agree.
So I don't think anyone disagrees.
Right? So, like, because we hear, like, she wasn't abusive to them. I'm just saying I think being raised in this world is inherently abusive. It also sounds a little bit like Andrea was kind of in the world of the cult all by herself.
Yes. I've got questions about that, actually, though. Because Rusty now is saying that he had nothing to do with it. It was all Andrea. And I don't know how much that is Rusty trying to distance himself from culpability.
I think it's super convenient for him to say, especially when what I've learned about Rusty in these three episodes so far is his, like, total disregard for his wife and for women, expectation about children, isolation of his family. Like, it seems like he's kind of a true believer.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that he's kind of like, well, I didn't know anything about that. But it's like, okay, well, you also, if the love of your life was writing to this thing that you were are distancing yourself from, maybe have that conversation too. I'm worried about you.
Yeah. It definitely seems like even before the postpartum depression kicked in with her, they were living separate lives in their marriage. Like, Rusty was getting up every morning and going to NASA, probably working very late, coming home, leaving very early.
An engineer at NASA.
That's a very hard job to get.
Yeah. And to me, it proves that he was in it for all the wrong reasons. Like, he was in the cult for the control, is what I think.
Yeah.
Because if you're surrounded by logic and science.
I will say, I find Rusty, at the very least, to be an unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I want to reiterate what I said in the last episode, which was that, like, when I look at him, I can't not see a man who lost five kids.
I hear that.
And you're going to tell us some really hard, gross, disgusting truths about him. And by the way, these are not opinions that Jillian found. These are, like, hardened facts.
It's from, like, the Fordham Law Review and, like, actual, like, court documents.
Yeah.
Real.
Yeah. And I will also say, you know, we could talk in circles about this for hours, but, like, he does not hold his wife accountable for what she did. He does not want to believe that what she did had anything to do with her religious, spiritual depression. He needs it all to be something in her brain that he couldn't do anything about.
Yeah, he doesn't just want it to be both ways. He wants it to be a lot of different ways, and that is not going to work for me. So during this trial, they don't really mention the cult that much. Like,
right.
They don't talk about that because we get a verdict.
Because I think in the insanity plea here, I think Wendell, the defense attorney, Andrew's attorney, is really leaning into the postpartum depression and trying to glean, like, trying to make the jury understand how really sick she was. And she really was.
Yes.
But even Wendell at this point doesn't fully understand that it's the clinical depression and the spiritual depression.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work.
And I think there's still a lot of stigma or a little too sciencey or whatever. People aren't really grasping how dire the situation was.
The inherent misogyny in that, by the way.
Insane.
That it doesn't matter how sick she really was. It will never be sick enough.
Well, she's just being emotional. Suck it up.
Yeah.
And is like, the thought.
I know you're joking, but I really do think that, like, even though it should be enough for them to describe her symptoms and get her doctors on mm-hmm. the stand and how really, truly sick she was, that should be enough.
Oh, sure.
It's going to take the magic of the evil yeah. religion to really drive this home. And Wendell didn't do that in the first trial.
So the verdict... Yeah, spoiler, there are two trials. So this verdict, it takes 35 minutes.
When you find out why there's a second trial, you're going to lose your mind.
She's guilty of capital murder, and she gets life, but not the death penalty.
Yeah.
And so David, we go back to David the yuppie, and he's like...
After the trial, I was thinking that Michael Warnecki is not being held accountable. He got a little bad press and all that, but he just marched on, and no one knows the real story. He's getting away with it. So I called a local news studio and told them that I have some information on this preacher.
He got a little bit of bad press, but he wasn't really talked about that much. He's back on his fucking freak bus and going around the world with his little kids, like yelling at people at shopping malls.
And now he's doing the talk show circuit
yes.
with his wife/servant, Rachel, which is how she signs the letters, everybody.
And he's lying about everything.
He's on ABC with Charlie Gibson defending himself.
And he's saying, because Charlie Gibson brings up David, because David is, you know, he's saying there's another man who said that you was driven crazy by you too. And Michael is like, what, that guy? I met him one time in a McDonald's. And Charlie Gibson is like, no, he said there were stacks of letters, but he doesn't have the proof. And it cuts to David, who's at a table with 1,000 tape recordings and like 5,000 right. letters. Like, Michael is just lying on national television and getting away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And he is blaming Rusty because Rusty, quote, didn't shepherd his wife.
Yes.
To which I say, number one, barf.
Yeah.
And two, I am of the belief that Rusty is very much to blame, but not for that reason, you psycho.
Right. Yes. Yes.
So let's talk about Steve, the cult leader's friend. Steve, I'm going to tell you right now, we don't really have a lot of time for bullshit.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to beg you, please, to fucking tread lightly and uh-huh. not pull any bullshit right now.
I
don't need the friend of the cult leader.
I'm with you, too.
When I first saw that, I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
This is the prime opportunity to say former friend, ex-friend, what acquaintance of.
I literally, like, shifted. I was like, Steve, I'm telling you.
I know.
We do not have time for this.
You know what? Steve does this pretty good here. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Steve says they grew up together. They went to school together. He makes it sound like they have the exact same birthday down to the year and day.
That's what I thought, too.
It's kind of unclear. The cult leader was a football player, a jock, and then he shifts gears to being this fanatical preacher. Like, again, like I've been saying, from the beginning, he
yeah.
was screaming and violent and awful.
And let me say, too, Steve is the one who tells us.
He tried to get into different seminaries, but he was rejected for being too fanatical, too earnest, too over the top. And so he was going to make his own way. And he did wear that rejection as a badge of honor.
He was too evangelical for the seminary.
Too fanatical.
Yeah.
So this is not, again, like, let's talk about limiting beliefs and, like,
right.
trade scarves. And now suddenly we're a sex cult and branding and abusing people. Like, no, he was this from day one.
And Steve is saying that it was when he was rejected by the seminaries that he had to decide that he wasn't the problem. Satan was the problem.
Well, they broke up. He broke up with them.
Exactly.
Not they and breaking. Yeah.
This becomes the basis of whatever religious bullshit he's spouting is that Satan, like, oh, the seminaries are run by Satan. That's why I didn't get in. The companies are run by
right.
Satan. That's why you can't work for General Mills.
It's a badge of honor now.
Yes. And now he alone is on a mission to go out and warn the world about how to be saved from Satan.
And he's screaming at strangers, churchgoers,
yes.
people at football games, people going to the movies, like anyone and everyone.
And he's starting it in his hometown. And Steve is here to be like, this guy went from being like the cool football jock to being like that fucking weirdo at the mall with the sign.
Yeah, he says aggressive and obnoxious. And things got real awkward when Steve started working as a police reporter.
I love it.
And had to write about the cult leader getting arrested. I took a screenshot of one of these signs. It's huge. It's like 10 feet by 10 feet and all in different colors. It's like Westboro Baptist. That's like the visual I have.
What does it say?
It says, your sin nature is driving you to hell. Come and repent to the living person of Jesus Christ, not Christianity, not church.
I mean, too much information. Do we not know how signs work?
I mean, he doesn't know how anything works.
You got a bumper sticker everything, Warnecki. Like, this is, that's too long.
But like, here's the straw that broke Steve's back or whatever. the camel's back, but yeah. Steve is the camel.
Oh, the Shrine Circus event?
This woman tells Steve that Michael basically, like, got physical with her and, quote, roughed her up pretty good. We don't get any details about that.
I will say, it says accosted her verbally, but whatever. Like, this guy's a piece of shit.
Well, he said, we get this screenshot of this woman saying that, like, Michael was telling everyone to sell their TVs and that everyone's a sinner and that this woman's going to hell and to lay down my monetary possessions. And she goes, it got to the point where she was in tears. And then we get this, like, they do that, like, pan, like, that zoom over the text. He said he was going to vomit me out of his mouth, to which I say, did he threaten to eat her?
What?
And then my crazy brain, I have to tell you about this funny line from The Sopranos that this made me think of.
Give it to me.
So Carm is, this is in the late 90s, right? Aida was on Broadway.
Oh!
So, please, I cannot talk about Aida. I cannot talk about it, which never could be made today. Everyone's super white and blonde in Egypt, apparently, according to Elton John. Oh, yeah, anyway, the music is so good.
But always been my strong.
Oh, Sherry Renee Scott and Heather Headley and Adam Pascal. Whatever, point is. So that was, like, big at the time. So Tony comes home and he's like, where's Meadow? And she's like, oh, she went out with Jackie Jr. She's seeing Aida. And Tony goes, I eat her? Like, he mishears. Aida as I eat her, and she's like, oh, Aida, God. It's the Elton John musical. But that, when I said—
at the end of that show, they put them in a pyramid to starve to death and die.
And they're happy to do it because they get to be in love.
It's a Disney musical.
It's like—
my God.
Unbelievable. But he said he was going to vomit. This is how my brain works, everyone, in case you're wondering, like, what's it like to be Jillian for 5 seconds? I read the words, he said he was going to vomit me out of his mouth. And then I go, did he threaten to eat her? And I can't say eat her without hearing Tony go, I eat her.
Oh, my God.
It's so fucking good. When I told Mike about it, he was like, please tell the listeners that story from The Sopranos if they don't already know.
That is, of course, Tony's never been to the fucking theater.
I know. I needed a chuckle. It's been 3 hours of this thing. And I was like, finally, James Gandolfini and Edie Falco.
That's my drag name.
Yep.
I needed to chuckle. Did I tell you about the drag name Steve came up with on vacation?
What?
Rafta Voreos. Pretty good, right?
Because you love Oreos.
Yeah, Rafta Voreos.
Rafta Voreos.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
That's like Kitty's Got Claws.
It was also Sleeve of Saltines.
Sleep. I thought you were going to say Sleepless in Seattle.
Sleepless in Seattle. It's a good one, but I'll do it.
So this woman wants to press charges, obviously. He wants to eat her and spit her out or whatever.
Oh, my God.
I'm sure that's some, like, biblical thing that he's co-opting. Yeah. I'm just like... I'm not here for this. So she's like, I want a full trial. She's like, I want to fucking throw the book at this guy.
I love it.
I love it
too.
Get
it, Susan.
The city's like...
The city cut a deal with him that he would leave town. And that was the start of his worldwide tour.
Steve's like, the problem with that is that that's what, like, forced him on this worldwide tour, as he calls it.
That's when he bought the fucking bus.
Right. So we also meet Douglas Roberts, who I love.
Yeah.
Another cult survivor. He met Michael on campus. Again, why is he allowed to do this on campus? Here we are.
This guy was an avid follower for a year and a half and was like, fuck that, what?
One day he woke up and he was like, oh, God, that was weird.
I like, feel like the first time I get a cassette tape in the mail, I'm like, I'm not listening to this. I've got Indigo Girls to get ready to. Like, I'm not doing this.
You know what you could do? You can just go, and you can just stop it.
Yeah. Throw it away.
Or you can, like, not read it.
Oh.
But a year later, so he was in the cult, like, right at the, close to the Andrea Yates thing. So he's out of the cult. And then a year after, Andrea Yates is on the news for doing this horrible thing.
Yeah.
And so Douglas, let me tell you something. I love this shit so much. He starts a website about the cult, trying to find others and rescue others and help others about this false prophet. He goes, the website says suicidal, homicidal, divorced, depressed, or psychotic. Like, I'm here for you.
Yes.
This shit is exhausting. I love when people do this. You know how much work this is?
Yeah.
What thankless work this is?
Well, he says they had thousands of views or contacted by at least 40 other people. Like, this guy is seeing the evil that is being done out there in the world.
And he's saying... this is what happened to Andrea Yates.
Yes.
Don't, like, he's using this, for lack of a better term, using this story to help people and do some good. Rusty, take notes.
Yes.
And so he's doing the good work here.
So speaking of the good work, we meet Ashlyn Hilliard. She's a cult intervention specialist. There's enough fucking cult in the world that we need intervention specialists.
I know. And we need a lot more of them.
We need a lot of them.
And she's like, yeah, this is a cult. Like, you don't need to be in person to be a cult. This is a psychological prison. Because David, the yuppie, finds the website and is like, oh my God, that's me. Can I work with you? I want to team up. Like,
yes.
Can we be lab partners?
Yes. And, like, Astrid is saying that, like, this guy puts people in psychological prison. That is where Andrea Yates was.
Because... and she's also in prison for the rest of her life because there was a verdict and it's over and the trial is done and she's in prison. So all of these people are coming together to say, like, there's more to this.
Well, the good news is...
So it's January 6th, 2005.
Oh, man.
I can't see January 6th without going like, oh God.
Oh, God.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
January 6th, 2005. I'm like, they don't even know what's happening.
I know.
In years, 15 years from now.
I can't. Whenever I would think, I would see the date as like 2018. I'm like, oh, my God, like 2 years from now, like the whole world's going to shut down. They don't even know that yet.
But on this January 6th, the conviction was overturned due to false testimony from an expert witness. So it all comes down to Law and Order because someone testified.
A state expert claimed Andrea Yates watched Law and Order and may have copied a plot where a mother used postpartum depression as a defense for drowning her children. However, it was later proven that no such episode ever existed.
That Andrea Yates stole this idea. There was an episode of Law and Order where this mother drowned her kids in the bathtub. Andrea Yates saw it, got inspired, and decided to do that. So that sort of negated this, like, postpartum thing. And people were like, oh, she's just crazy.
Some law clerk had to watch every single episode of Law and Order to make sure that that episode did not exist.
So the expert witness was the one who 3 years later was like, I was wrong. There actually wasn't an episode.
She did?
They came back.
I'm assuming it's a woman because she's the one who would, like, admit her mistake and get Andrea Yates out of jail.
But it took 3 years for them to realize, like, actually there wasn't.
You know what I mean? That's a really fucked up thing to, like, to testify to.
So, yeah. So, but thankfully, this person came back and was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm saying this.
That's crazy.
There's actually no, and this was, like, this trial was in 2001 or whatever.
Oh my God.
There wasn't really a full, on the internet, you can find anything. You can find the script for that episode in 2 seconds.
Oh, for sure.
So it took 3 years. So 4 years or whatever. So now we're in the second trial.
And we meet Todd. Todd is the jury foreman. He goes, I got the call to be on the Andrea Yates trial and I gasped. I was like, me too. I was like, I can't imagine.
But this trial is really, really different because the defense knows we got to talk about the cult. We really have to explain.
That's the thing. Like, even though it's the postpartum, I can't even remember the word they used. Like, she was out of her mind. Even though that should be enough, it was not. And Wendell's like, bring in the tapes, bring in the pamphlets. We got to show them what this man was doing to her, what this man got her to believe.
And Andrea's extended mental health history.
Yes.
Of which there is much more than what has been brought up here.
Yeah.
Then we meet Dr. Philip Resnick. He's a forensic psychiatrist. He interviewed Andrea Yates then, and he's here with us now.
Yeah.
She was paranoid. She was hallucinating.
She claims that she and the children would watch cartoons. The characters would speak directly to her, telling her she was a bad mother. Mrs. Yates believed that she was marked as evil. She believed she had 666 tattooed on her head.
She felt she was marked by the devil. She thought 666 was tattooed on her head, that Satan was inside her.
It's crazy to see her in this, because we're seeing the interview that he did with her after she was arrested. You can tell that she's sad, but she felt like she saved her kids.
Can you imagine how lonely and terrifying that must be?
I cannot.
To say, I feel like Satan is in me right now in every fiber of my being, and then reaching out to someone about it and either having your husband not believe you or having a cult leader write, like, well, you fucking deserve it.
Yes.
You know what you have to do. Like, how lonely and scary and terrifying that must be.
I'll be interested to talk more about her extended mental health history.
Yeah.
Because she was in so deep.
She was in a lot.
She was in so deep.
Yeah. And so now we have to talk about one of the cult pamphlets called The Perilous Times.
Like, get it? My God.
Get it? Ba-dum-bum.
Wait, I don't get it.
Where it's like, these are perilous times, but instead of like the New York Times, the Seattle Times, it's like The Perilous Times.
Oh, God.
They're trying to have jokes.
I know.
Mm-mm.
I know.
Not on this witch's watch.
Not on this witch's watch. So they present one section of The Perilous Times. And, like, Todd, the jury foreman, is like, it's all right there.
It's right here.
Every single thing that she believed that made her kill her kids is right here in this text that was, like, sworn to her by her spiritual master, was, like, came directly from God.
Mm-hmm.
They present the part of the pamphlet that says,
a child becomes no longer a child, they become no longer innocent. If they're not saved before the age of 12, which is the age of accountability, you're going to hell.
And if you had not taken their lives, what did you think would happen to them?
If they were to continue to stumbling.
And where would they end up?
Hell.
All all the kids that I need you, that all the men in the room need you to have one after the other, whether you want it or not.
Yep.
Now you have to kill them.
Yeah, because you only got 12 years to save them. You couldn't do it.
That is fucking insane.
Yes.
That's not what any God wants. That's fucking crazy.
So Todd says, these trials go by fast in this documentary.
Very.
So Todd says, we go to the jury room. 8 of us believe that she was not guilty by reason of insanity. 4 believe that she was guilty. So to get into her mind and try to understand if she knew what she was doing was wrong, they request 2 things. They request pictures of the kids and a copy of the perilous times that they knew was in the house on the day that she killed the kids. Because remember, at trial, they only got to see that one panel of it.
It's like an instruction manual.
It's an instruction manual.
So it's July 26th, 2006, and we get the verdict of the second trial. She is not guilty by reason of insanity.
And you can see the look on her face. She's stunned by this verdict.
And I think she's been stunned. Like, she hasn't gotten any help yet.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, now she's dealing with this horrible thing. And for some shitty reason, the documentary doesn't tell us what happened after that.
Yeah.
So I will.
Okay.
At the time of the murder, she was suffering on paper, like, clinically from severe postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis, and schizophrenia. Those are her diagnoses at the time.
And this was her going into the trial?
Yeah, like, when this happened.
Yeah.
So that's why the not guilty by reason of insanity, yes, like, holds up.
Yeah, yeah.
She's been at Kerrville State Hospital since 2007, which is a mental facility.
I would be curious to know what the conditions are like. Is it like a prison or is it more like a hospital?
I read the term like low security.
Okay.
It's more like a hospital. She is granted a yearly review annually to see if she can leave. And every single year she refuses it.
I wonder what the reception for her would be if she was released, especially after this documentary.
She has never once had a review. She always chooses to continue treatment is the word they said.
Oh, so she can opt out of the review.
Yeah, but like every year she can be reviewed and it can be decided if she is like, quote, well enough to leave. And she doesn't even want the conversation.
Yeah.
She wants to be in there probably to punish herself in her mind, but also like she continues the treatment. Her defense lawyer says that she talks about her children, grieves for her children every single day. She like watches a lot of home videos. Like she has access to all of that. So she is like sitting with what happened.
I can't even imagine.
She spends her time making aprons, cards, and gifts in the craft room and she anonymously sells them and the money goes to the Yates Children Memorial Fund.
Wow.
Which is something that was founded by her lawyer and his wife and dedicated to women's mental health and particularly like postpartum mental health. I donated to it. You should too. It's the Yates Children Memorial Fund. But like, people are I don't know where she's selling it.
I'm dumbfounded.
I know. I don't know where she's selling this stuff, but like there are people in the world who have purchased things.
Yeah.
Because it's not like, oh, the Andrea Yates, like she's not doing it for that.
Right.
She's like working it as her way of healing or whatever. She's making something and like raising money for this fund to help women, hopefully like not like her. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, yes, yes. Sorry, I'm just like my head is spinning.
I know. So it's very odd to me that they didn't say, they just said like, not guilty by reason of insanity. Yeah, but what does that mean? Where is she? Like, what happens? So that's what's out there. We'll get more about Rusty later, but I thought it was important to say now, like, where she is.
Yeah.
Instead of just, like, going right by it and back with Rusty, who won't even admit that it was a cult.
Rusty would say things like, Mike had influence, but it was, you know, Andrea was psychotic because of her depression. I think that he wasn't aware that other people went through some abuse from Michael.
And he won't acknowledge that the cult had anything to do with the murder of the children. He needs it to be the clinical depression.
And they hand him this perilous times thing, like, but see what, like, don't you see the connection here? And he sort of pushes it away and goes, interesting.
Yeah, I'm curious about the emotional motivation here with him.
Like why he's here for the doc?
No, like why he reacts to these things the way that he did, why he needs it to not have anything to do with the cult. And I think that part of it is culpability for him. But at the same time, like we don't have to go over this again, but I just get stuck on the fact that like, in order to get out of bed every day, when your 5 kids are dead, part of you has to just be dead. Part of you just has to like get, just be stoned. Like, we're gonna see this really awkward moment between him and Moses at the end of this thing.
Right now.
Well, because Moses really wants to connect with Rusty. He wants to say to him, and like Moses, like, I love Moses and I want to go to a comedy show.
Yeah.
It's like, he seems great to me, but he really wants to say to Rusty.
When I found out what happened with your family, I was I was jealous of your kids because they did it. They, in my definition of heaven, they, yeah.
Oh, well.
I hate to say it, but I was jealous when your kids died because I knew they were going to heaven. I knew where they were going. I knew why she did it, and I didn't get to go there.
And he says, I mean, Moses says that to us.
He says that verbatim to Rusty. Rusty does not have the response that Moses wants. Rusty is shut down. He is, like, he is emotionally unavailable. He's not rude to Moses, but he's just not willing to, like, take it in.
Well, I don't think Rusty knew, because at the beginning, we, like, see them meet. This is all at Moses' request.
Yeah.
And, like, Moses thinks, imagine being Moses and you're like, oh, my God, finally someone else who gets it. No one else can get it unless you were in it. I don't know if he's met David the Yuppie or whatever, but, like, he thinks that he and Rusty are going to have this, like, oh, my God.
Rusty's
he's like,
not, Rusty does not want that.
He cannot relate.
Yeah.
And, like, it's he's very clearly shocked that Moses is, like, so affected by what happened.
Yeah.
And this is not what Rusty signed up for. And so Moses wants to be like, right, so, like, tell me more about that and really, like, have this give and take. And Rusty is, like, any agreement or any, like, quote, bonding is so disingenuous from Rusty because I think he's doing what he, like, trying to get, like, yes, you know, give Moses kind of what he wants, but it's not real.
And we'll never really know what's going on in Rusty's head, but I have to allow for the possibility that Rusty has just been through. I know we're going to, you're going to tell us some awful things about this guy, but at the same time, he sat down to talk to a documentary for God only knows how long about the murder of his, like, five kids.
Yeah, I'm confused about that too.
And so, like, well, but what I'm saying is I think that, like, he must be emotionally shut down in this moment. Mm-hmm. And I think, because I, like, It's a weird way to end the documentary because it's kind of like there's no emotional payoff here. Nobody really knows what Rusty is thinking or feeling. Moses is not getting the emotional response that he wants for his own healing.
Right.
And then it's over. And then we get this, like, on-screen text.
Right. Rusty Yates continues to work for NASA.
Yeah.
Which should scare you. He has a son from a second marriage. He got married a year after the arrest. David the Yuppie is a retired pharmaceutical representative. He lived that yuppie life.
Good for him.
He enjoys his time writing, and he has a daughter and is living in Houston, Texas.
Yes.
And your favorite.
And then this is where we learn that Moses is an acclaimed comedian living in Los Angeles. When I saw that when I watched this for the first time yesterday, I screamed.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
It's great.
Because Moses is, like, so serious, obviously. Like through he's, like, a great storyteller in this documentary.
Yeah.
But then I watched his comedy clips, and he's fucking funny.
Well, you know, I appreciate this about Moses and David. They showed up to this thing.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
They showed up. This is what we're here for.
Yeah.
So to date, no criminal charges have been filed against the cult leader and his wife. And the cult leader and his wife continue to travel and preach around the world. They have a website that I'm not going to talk about here.
It's absolutely insane.
Yeah. Let's talk more about Rusty.
Okay.
It is my opinion that I think he should have been charged with something. I think he's culpable here. Here are some things the doc left out. These sources include papers from the Cleveland State Law Review and Fordham Law School and, like, quotes from, I showed them all to you today, actual documents.
Yeah.
So this isn't me, like, just ranting and raving.
No.
The timeline of what happened isn't really fully explained in this documentary. Like, Andrea had a very well-documented history of mental health struggles that Rusty knew about. And I think the Fordham Law School one, it's an actual timeline month to month of, like, what she said, what she was feeling, the medications, when she came back. Like, not only were they told not to have more children, like, very clearly, but Rusty was told not to leave Andrea alone specifically because it would lead to tragedy.
Yeah.
So to they were like, no, like, in the trial, the doctor's like, the doctor is asked, like, and you said that because of the circumstance, like. And he was like, yes. So Rusty's bullshit is hard for me to hear when it's like, why were you how can you use the word catatonic and in the same breath be like, and then off I went to work?
Yeah, I agree 100%.
When he was told very clearly many times by many doctors. Rusty said earlier that they only talked about children after they got married, which was weird because I was like, that's a conversation you have before you get married, right?
For sure, yeah.
No, from court documents, the couple confidently announced to wedding guests that they would not use birth control. They wanted as many children as nature would provide. Within 3 months, Andrea was pregnant with the first five children. That's a quote. He also claimed earlier that Andrea was afraid of the negative influence of school, so that she was pushing for the homeschool, and Rusty was like, what am I to do? I was overruled. No, the truth is that she homeschooled her children because, quote, her husband was concerned that the children might pick up bad habits. So he's like now quoting himself, but attributing it to Andrea today in this documentary.
Wow.
And it's like, why can't you just say that's what we believed?
Yeah.
It's odd to me that everything is her fault. Everything is her idea. Just say, this is what we believed. You can still believe it.
Like, yes.
It's odd. Like, that's why everything is now suspicious. Because why are we lying about things like this, right?
Yeah.
And the thing that's really sad is that Andrea was thriving before Rusty. Like, she was lively and social. When she was growing up, she was the captain of the swim team. She was the president of the National Honor Society. She was the valedictorian.
Why wasn't any of this in the documentary?
She was, like, a highly regarded nurse. Like, she had a thriving life. Like, captain of the swim team, president of the National Honor Society, and valedictorian.
Yeah, why didn't we know any of this?
And and I think it's important to show, like, what a bright light she really was. Because after Rusty, Andrea never personally said anything like critical of her husband, but her best friend Debbie Holmes and her mother have described Rusty as controlling, critical, and demanding. Andrea let her husband make decisions for the family. Her mother and Debbie Holmes said that Andrea lost her identity. Andrea's mother describes Rusty as manipulative and controlling, and is on the record saying that Rusty pushed her to have the baby, the fifth baby, especially knowing that tragedy could strike.
Yeah.
There are like a lot of notes from her. I'm sorry. Thanks for bearing with me, everyone.
No,
I just think this is really important.
We're not bearing with you. This is important information.
And like notes from her group therapy sessions in August of 1999. She says, well, Rusty permits her to have a few hours per week to spend as she pleases. It says the group encourages her to assert herself. Andrea expresses a desire to learn how to enjoy herself again. She's feeling stifled. And Rusty's like, fine, you can do whatever you want for like an hour.
Yeah.
And then the next day, August 17th, 1999, she says that she wants to be more communicative, but that Russell usually turns on the TV when he's at home. So he's not just not hearing her, he's shutting her out. He doesn't want to hear it. You know, and like,
it just sounds so lonely.
She's struggling and trying to talk about it. And like, she's in these group therapy sessions and then like wants to tell her husband about it. And he's turning on she's in group. This is 1999.
Yeah.
The murders happened in 2000. And so like, the quote, there's another quote that says, Mrs. Yates agreed to Rusty's plan to have a large family and was determined to be a supermom. And she told her prison psychiatrist that after Mary, their youngest child, was born, she told Rusty that she didn't want to have sex because the other doctor was warning her about how dangerous it could be to her and her children. Rusty, she said, simply asserted his procreative religious beliefs, complimented her as a good mother, and persuaded her that she could handle more children.
And that came from who?
That came from the notes from her prison psychiatrist.
Wow.
And the thing that really, like, I want to hit home, because I would just talk around in circles and not say it coherently— from the notes, it says, I think this is the Fordham Law Review, it may never be known to what extent Andrea's pregnancies were based on a mutual decision with Rusty or primarily a product of Rusty's desire for a large family. A number of people, including Andrea's mother and her friend Debbie Holmes, suggested Rusty was a dominating force in the Yates family, including the decision to have babies. So there is a major consent issue here that is not being discussed. It is my opinion that Rusty is a liar, that he used religion to control and manipulate and dominate her. I don't think every pregnancy was consensual. I don't think every sexual experience was consensual. I think he ignored and diminished her mental health. He, like on the record, ignored. I don't even know if it's a directive from the doctor. I don't know if a doctor could say, like, you're not allowed to have any more children, but it was pretty clear what was going on. And the timeline is written out over years. So this whole, like, only after the fourth child did she kind of become a little quiet, that's a lie. That is a proven lie in court documents. And, like, I think he was complicit. Like, I do. I think he was complicit in this. And I think that he should have been charged. And I resent the fact that he's here not doing any good work for so many other women who suffer on a regular basis. And he just, like, wanted to get married and have more kids as soon as possible. And that's what he did.
And he got married, like, less than a year after.
Like, a year after and had a kid. And they're divorced now. You know, thank God for her. But, like, It's all right there for you.
It's the kind of thing that makes you be like, then why did we make this documentary?
I know.
Or why did we make it the way that we did?
And there's a lot more that I didn't mention, but this is a starting off point. If you want to do your research, it is all there for you. These are all public things. I didn't pay for it. This is not behind a paywall. This is all public, like 100-page essays, like things that are written, because this case has been studied just like the hot coffee case.
Yeah, of course.
It's in law books now of like, this is something that really happens. Because there are people that don't believe in postpartum depression. There are people who don't believe in the power of cults. You know, like there's a lot of work to be done about this. So hopefully we did our part a little bit today.
Well, you sure did.
Oh, thanks, girl.
Oh, girl, we did Andrea Yates, the cult behind the killer. I was not like, please don't misinterpret my silence as disagreement. My mind is blown. We're dealing with a bunch of dead kids. That's a real hard trigger for me.
I and the YouTube viewers have the privilege of seeing you, so I knew that you weren't checking out in any way.
You're so good at that. You really are so good at like getting the receipts and citing your sources and
But also
managing your thoughts in a way that are like coherent and like make sense.
I tried. I was like in it a lot today. Yeah. I was like, letters were flying off my keyboard. You know, I had to say it in a way that was like not getting, I don't know, maybe this is the misogyny, but like not shading it and me just like being angry and screaming.
Yeah.
I tried to present it in a way that was like, you guys should listen to this.
You nailed it.
If you're at home.
You absolutely nailed
it.
All right, tell them what we're doing next.
We're going back to Smugshot because goddamn it, we need a break.
Oh, God.
So this is the Dalí heist. This is about the Salvador Dalí painting.
Yes, she loves an art heist.
So goddamn it, we needed it.
We need it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's the second season. It's the Dalí heist.
All right, we'll put it in the Facebook group. We'll make sure you get it. It's on Netflix, right?
It's on like the Sundance Channel. It's somewhere. It's on Amazon Prime. Okay. It's like in a few different places.
Yeah, I'm exhausted.
Wait, this is like a palate. This is like a week palate cleanser for everyone next week.
Okay,
you know what I mean?
Yeah. Let's steal some.
Can you imagine if I was like, for my next trick, I'm going to torture you even more. No, we're doing a fucking art heist, everybody.
God. All right, I'm excited.
You're welcome.
Can I go home now?
Yes, everyone take good care of yourselves and the people you love, please. You know, do something. Go to bed nice and early. Watch some Schitt's Creek, a little bit of Alexis.
Watch some Schitt's Creek, absolutely. Oh, my God.
I love you guys.
We love you, fam.
Bye, stay safe.
Bye.
I'm sitting there with my wife and the baby. And the news is on TV. I'm saying, you know, I'm happy. I'm so proud of my son. I said, Fran, the baby's beautiful and all that. And all of a sudden, across the TV goes,
welcome back from Rikers Island, New York City's famous or infamous jail. Of all places comes word of an art heist as surreal as the art itself.
Oh, shit. And I looked at my wife and said, well, I'm happy we have a baby, but I'll see you in about 18 years. Because I think I'm going to jail.